From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
And I'm Callum Borchers in Boston. It's Here and Now. Texas today urged the Supreme Court to leave the state's restrictive abortion law in place. Texas was responding to the Department of Justice, which has filed an emergency application asking the court to block the law. It effectively bans abortions in Texas after 6 weeks, and it's intensified a long-running political fight. Some conservatives hope the Texas law is a step toward ending legal abortions, with a right-leaning majority now on the Supreme Court. Here to help us make sense of it all is Stephen Vladeck from the University of Texas School of Law. He's an expert on federal courts. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Professor, could you just sort of lay out the stakes here? Could this Texas case effectively overturn Roe v. Wade?
Oh, it certainly could. And I think, you know, that's indeed what some of its supporters are hoping it will. But also keep in mind that the Supreme Court is already set to hear argument in December in a case out of Mississippi about a Mississippi law that bans just about all abortions after the 15th week of pregnancy, where Mississippi, some other states, and even some members of Congress have already asked the court to overrule Roe. So that's what's sort of swimming in the water as the Supreme Court decides what to do.
So there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of numbers to keep track of, too. But for folks who are trying to understand what the stakes are here, 6 weeks, 15 weeks, those are both earlier than sort of what the legal precedent is right now, 22 to 24 weeks. And that's part of what makes these cases so significant. I'm wondering, Professor, if you think the court then is likely to take up this Texas case alongside the Mississippi case.
Yeah, I think it looks increasingly like that's a possibility. I mean, earlier this week, when the federal government asked the justices to lift the Fifth Circuit stay, basically to put back on hold the Texas law that had been blocked by a district court, they also asked the Supreme Court to leapfrog the Court of Appeals, the Fifth Circuit, and take the case on the merits. The providers in their separate challenge to the Texas law have asked for the same thing. And so, yeah, I think it's a distinct possibility that as early as tomorrow, you know, we're going to hear from the Supreme Court that they actually do want to have the Texas law up before them alongside the Mississippi law. Then I think the real question becomes, what happens until then? Are the justices going to leave in place the Fifth Circuit stay, which means SB 8 would still be in effect, which means abortions would still be just about unavailable to Texans from the 6th week of pregnancy onwards? Or is the court going to side with the federal government temporarily and allow the law to be frozen while it decides what to do on the merits? I think that's the other thing to watch for.
I'm wondering, Professor, what your take, though, is on this notion that, you know, now there's a conservative majority on the court, that means Roe v. Wade is in jeopardy. We know the conservative justices are not a monolith. I mean, what do we know about how each one of them individually is thinking about this issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question, Callum, that at least a couple of them are probably ready to and willing to overrule Roe and Casey and basically to eliminate any constitutional protection for a right to pursue an abortion at any stage in pregnancy. I think it's just not clear if there are six of them or even five, which, of course, is the relevant number. And that's why it might actually be attractive to someone like Chief Justice John Roberts, who's worried about the court as an institution, to put the Texas case alongside the Mississippi case and potentially hand down what, at least from the court's perspective, would be a split verdict, where the court might say the Mississippi law is okay, 15 weeks is still shorter than what Roe and Casey allowed, but there's a meaningful opportunity under the Mississippi law for those who are pregnant to still obtain an abortion, but 6 weeks is too short.
You know, you mentioned the concern that Chief Justice Roberts has about the perception of the court as a political entity. And just to put a number on that, there was a national survey just last week that said a broad majority of Americans, more than 6 in 10, feel that way. I think the court makes rulings based on politics instead of the law. I'm just wondering how you think that might play into the way the court conducts itself in a case like this. Are they trying to avoid that explicitly?
So, I mean, I think, again, we come back to the court being, you know, a they, not an it. This is as, you know, sort of visible an example of this phenomenon as we're going to get. Are the justices going to do what many of them were appointed to do and eviscerate the right that the Supreme Court recognized 48 years ago in Roe? Or are the justices going to look at the role of the Supreme Court as an institution, look at the divisiveness over this issue in the American polity, and say maybe the best thing we can do is actually not lean too heavily one way or the other? That's why the Texas case, ironically, now gives the court a way to try to look like it's not acting, you know, in a sort of strictly partisan manner to look like it actually is reflecting some kind of deeper principles. I think the question is, are the justices going to take that invitation? And really, that's not a question about John Roberts. It's a question about the other five conservatives.
That's Stephen Vladeck, a professor at the University of Texas School of Law and an expert on the federal courts. Professor, thanks.
Thank you.
Plastic is the new coal. That's according to a new report out today by Beyond Plastics at Bennington College. They've analyzed 10 stages of plastics production, use, and disposal, and find that by the end of this decade, in just 9 years, plastics will be on track to contribute to more greenhouse gas emissions than coal-fired power plants. Judith Ink is a former regional EPA administrator and president of Beyond Plastics, and she joins us now. Judith, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks very much.
People get that coal-fired power plants generate greenhouse gases and that plastic is created from fossil fuels. But what's changed to make plastic on track to surpass coal power plants for greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, two things have changed. One is historically plastics were made from chemicals and oil. Now they're made from chemicals and a byproduct of hydrofracking. We have a tremendous build-out of plastic facilities and petrochemical facilities. And at the same time, thankfully, coal plants are being retired. About 65% of U.S. coal plants have been shut down. And as you mentioned, Tanya, I think the public understands the problems with coal plants. But now we need to really grasp that plastic pollution is not just a serious water quality issue, and we know that plastic recycling is a myth with only 8.5% of plastics getting recycled. But now we absolutely have to put plastic production and disposal on the climate change agenda.
Your report goes into detail on emissions from hydrofracking, but how do you know how much of these emissions are connected to plastics? And has that kind of analysis been done before?
We know that large ethane cracker facilities are being constructed mostly in Texas and Louisiana and a few other states in Appalachia. And large amounts of fracked waste gas is being sent by pipeline to ethane cracker facilities. In order for these facilities to operate, they need permits from environmental regulatory agencies. So we have the estimates of what the greenhouse gas emissions are from fracking. If anything, I think our report vastly underestimates the greenhouse gas emissions from plastics, because there are some sources in this 10 high impact stages that you don't have specific permit information on. For instance, our report has a section on foamed plastic insulation in people's homes that off-gases greenhouse gas emissions. And a growing amount of plastic is burned at cement kilns. Unfortunately, the federal EPA considers this alternative fuels. There's absolutely no measurement of the emissions from burning those plastics.
Okay, so are we seeing even more plastic in the world? I'm actually not sure how we notice in a world saturated with plastics.
Yes, the projections are that the production of plastic is only going to increase worldwide. The fossil fuel industry knows that they're losing money from burning fossil fuels at coal plants. They're going to lose money from petroleum sales because more and more people are shifting to electric cars, investments in mass transit. And so plastic production is the plan B for the fossil fuel industry.
You're also tracking how much this pollution occurs in communities of color. What are you finding?
Yes, this is so important. We looked at the climate pollution in communities of color, and we learned that 90% of the climate pollution that the plastics industry reports themselves to the EPA occurs in just 18 communities, mostly in Texas and Louisiana. And these are low-income communities and often communities of color. And quite frankly, this is one thing that inspired Beyond Plastics to do this report, because we are extremely concerned about the health impacts in communities of color that are already shouldering an overburdened level of air pollution.
Judith Ink is president of the group Beyond Plastics at Bennington College. Her report, The New Coal, Plastics and Climate Change, is out today. We've reached out to the Plastics Industry Association for comment on this report, and we'll post their response on our website, hereandnow.org. Today is Latina Equal Pay Day, when we are learning more about women's struggles to make a fair living. Here's an example. A Latina woman on average earns about $2,400 a month less than a white non-Hispanic man. That's nearly $29,000 less a year. Diana Ramirez has been advocating to change this statistic. She's a senior manager of policy and coalitions workplace justice at the National Women's Law Center, and she joins us now from El Paso, Texas. Diana, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Tanya. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Can you break down your analysis from the National Women's Law Center for this a bit further? How wide is the wage gap in this country for Latina women?
So Latinas in this country are typically paid 57 cents for every dollar paid to white non-Hispanic men. That means over a career of 40 years, Latinas are going to lose $1.2 million. So what is $1.2 million, right? $1.2 million is her retirement fund. It's her kids' college fund. It's her rainy day fund, right? It's the ability to build wealth for future generations. And I'm seeing that play out in El Paso during this pandemic. The Latinas in my family lost their jobs. And one of my aunts in particular, Elizabeth, she got an encephalitis infection, a swelling of the brain, and she became disabled. And she didn't have any savings. She had worked her entire life providing childcare, daycare for disabled adults, ironically. And when she needed someone to take care of her, she didn't have any savings. She didn't have health insurance. She never earned enough to pay into that. And so my family had to resort to what many families do in this country to pay for healthcare. We had to start a GoFundMe account just to pay for somebody to take care of her during the day. So that's what that means. That's what the 57 cents for every dollar means.
This is how it bores out in the quality of life for women. Absolutely. Your analysis was able to pinpoint some of the reasons why. Can you give us just a slice of what contributes to this overall gap?
I mean, this is everyday sexism. This is the stereotype that women should be home, taking care of the kids, providing home needs for the family. This is a stereotype that women don't want to be in the workforce as much. They need flexibility. They need to be in and out of the workforce. And that stereotype follows Latinas over their lifetime because, going back to my aunt's example, had she had a savings, we could have helped pay for somebody to take care of her now, but she didn't have that. And so that meant that her daughter, Teresa, had to take on student loans, right? She has six-figure student loan debt. And now that she's having to take care of her disabled mother and her toddlers, her two toddlers, the wage gap that she has faced over her years is kind of sandwiching her into this, caregiving for two generations. And so this wage gap affects generation after generation after generation.
This is not a problem that can be solved overnight, of course. But what are some solutions that you feel encouraged by to help close this gap?
We absolutely need to raise the minimum wage in this country. because so many Latinas are in those minimum wage paying jobs. And the minimum wage has been stagnant for the longest period of time in U.S. history. The gap between the 1% and the 99% has gotten so wide in this country that just raising the minimum wage would bring so many Latinas out of poverty. So we absolutely need to get to a $15 federal minimum wage with one fair wage for tipped workers, meaning that in every state, tipped workers get the same minimum wage before tips, because the majority of workers in tipped occupations are women. So we need to raise a wage. We also need to pass at the federal level the Paycheck Fairness Act, because what that does, it prohibits employers from asking salary history. Because when you have two candidates applying for a job and you ask them, what did you make before? What do you want to make now? That is where Latinas get trapped in these low wages, because we are always making less. And when they ask us, what do you want to make? We always ask for less. So we need to pass those two bills, the minimum wage bill called the Raise a Wage Act and the Paycheck Fairness Act, would be monumental in changing the poverty levels of Latinas today.
Diana Ramirez is Senior Manager of Policy and Coalitions Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center. Diana, thank you so much for talking with us about this important issue.
Thank you, Tanya.
Most big sports arenas use a lot of fossil fuel to heat and cool the buildings. They're energy hogs. But backers of the rebuilt Key Arena in Seattle say it will be the greenest in the world. The NHL's Seattle Kraken play their first home game of the season at the new Climate Pledge Arena on Saturday. KUOW's Joshua McNichols looked into the claims of greenness.
Architect Jason McLennan has spent his life working to make buildings more sustainable. He basically invented living buildings in 1998, which are buildings inspired by nature and held accountable to certain goals. They draw energy from the sun and reuse their own rainwater like a plant does. McLennan also grew up playing hockey. His dad almost went pro. The Climate Pledge Arena let him bring both those passions together.
Well, I gotta say that this is actually an exciting moment for me as we walk out into the arena. This is the first time I've seen the ice revealed, actually, since I've been here. So it's a bit of a moment.
Take the ice, for example, that the Kraken will play their games on. McLennan says it's different than the ice at other hockey arenas.
One of the things that makes this ice so special is where the water comes from to make the ice. And what we're doing on the Climate Pledge Arena is we're collecting water from the roof that falls naturally. Rainfall, we're famous for here in Seattle. We're collecting that rainwater in a series of gutters and pipes.
The water flows into a 15,000-gallon underground tank. From there, it's pumped and filtered whenever it's needed to build up a new floor or to feed the Zamboni. The building is full of little details like that.
And so we have solar panels.
The big picture is that Climate Pledge Arena will be certified carbon neutral. It doesn't use any fossil fuels. It offsets any carbon it produces. And by 2024, almost all its waste will be recycled or composted. McLellan says all the sustainability calculations will be published online every year.
I think that's an incredibly important thing that people can call us on it.
Amazon bought the naming rights to the arena, but instead of calling it Amazon Arena, the company used the name to highlight its climate pledge. I wanted to know if the claims about this arena were just a big marketing stunt, you know, greenwash. So I asked a couple faculty members at the University of Washington College of Built Environments, and they gave me two different responses. Kate Simonen is the chair of the architecture school, and she runs something called the Carbon Leadership Forum. She's spent years pushing organizations to take their sustainability goals seriously. She says Climate Pledge Arena is like a dream come true.
Oh, I feel excited. I feel really excited. I mean, the commitment to net zero by 2040 is where everybody needs to be going. And so to have a major, what I would consider almost public resource, attacking the climate challenge so aggressively is wonderful.
I went upstairs for a second opinion. Manish Chalana is with the Urban Planning Department, and he's a little less excited.
It's a narrow way of thinking about sustainability, and I'm not being overly critical as to what they're doing. It's good. It's good to be thinking about environmental sustainability. There's no doubt about that.
But Chalana says real sustainability is a three-legged stool. In Seattle, he says we do a good job talking about one leg of that stool, environmental sustainability. But we're less focused on the other two legs of the stool, social and economic sustainability.
I want projects like this to address all three pillars of sustainability before they can make that claim that they're truly sustainable.
Take economics, for example. It's true, the backers of this building spent around $1 billion of their own money to remodel it. But Chalana argues, in the end, the building is publicly owned, and he thinks the public is giving away too much of its future profits. Rob Johnson disagrees. He's a former city council member who now works for the Seattle Kraken. He says, consider the way things are usually done.
Traditionally, a sports team owner comes to a city or a local government and says, I want to keep my team here. But in order for me to keep my team here, I need hundreds of millions of dollars in municipal bonds or other financing in order to upgrade my building so we can stay competitive. And then I'm going to keep 100% of the profits of that facility.
Johnson says this arena flipped that approach on its head. It created a public building using private money, and the city gets a share of the future profits.
Some advertising revenue, the parking revenue.
It may take years to fully understand whether Climate Pledge Arena was as good a deal as we're being told. But in the meantime, it's definitely raising the bar for the environmental sustainability of big construction projects. For Here and Now, I'm Joshua McNichols in Seattle.
A few short years ago, WeWork was the darling of the startup world. Then the pandemic hit, and they became synonymous with being a failed IPO. Today, however, their stock is being traded. And the big question is, will investors embrace the office setup enough to dig up from their deep financial hole? Joining us, as he often does to talk about these things, is Bloomberg's new senior editor, Mike Regan. Welcome back, Mike.
Oh, thank you, Tanya.
So today, WeWork is valued at around $9 billion. That's a sharp drop from 2019's $47 billion valuation. Tell us about WeWork's rocky road to this IPO and how the stock is looking now.
Right. So when it first tried to go public in 2019, WeWork, you know, filed the standard paperwork that basically lays out all the details of its business. And there were just a lot of red flags that jumped out at would-be investors, especially when it comes to the company's relationship with its founder, Adam Neumann. There were controversial loans and controversial transactions, and it basically, you know, caused a backlash that prevented them from actually pulling the IPO off and going public. This time, it's trying a different approach, which is what's known as a special purpose acquisition company. They're also known as blank check companies, because basically the way it works is a company raises a bunch of money on the stock market, and then it finds a company to buy. And that's what's going on with WeWork. A SPAC has bought them and basically transformed them into a public company that way. But as you point out, that stock is doing well today in its debut. But it's, you know, on a company with a valuation of about $9 billion compared to that $47 billion valuation that it had in 2019 before it went public. So quite a different sort of, you know, value for the company at this point.
You mentioned the co-founder, Adam Neumann. There are quite a few TV projects in the pipeline right now that's really delving into his charismatic representation of their business model. What is his role in the company now?
So he has basically forfeited any management role, and he's no longer on the board of directors. He does have an observer's role on the board of directors, but the company's made it very clear that he does not have the right to influence any decisions by the board or any actions they take. He still does own about 9% of the company. So that stake and some of the settlements he's had through all the litigation that followed the canceled IPO, he's got a net worth of about $2.3 billion. So he's still a very influential figure towards the company as a shareholder, but doesn't have any direct management responsibilities.
I have about a minute with you. There's a lot more competition now for this space of shared working spaces. Where does WeWork stand now in that pecking order?
It still is really the behemoth, about 800 locations around the world. There are plenty of other competitors catching up, companies like Spaces and Impact Hub. But WeWork is still very much the big story in this space. And what they're hoping now is that after the pandemic, they'll be able to sign up employees of big companies, not just sort of startups and entrepreneurs that you typically think of in co-working spaces. They're talking about actually signing up employees of big corporations. So that's sort of their sales pitch going forward now.
A lot to watch for. That's Mike Regan, a senior editor with Bloomberg News. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Been a big year for Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Chiara Alegría-Hudi's. In the Heights, the film she produced and co-wrote with Lin-Manuel Miranda, opened in June, and in April she published My Broken Language, a deeply personal memoir about growing up in Philadelphia with her vibrant Puerto Rican mother and her abuela, her grandmother, on whose steps she heard the stories that would inspire her art. I spoke with Chiara Alegría-Hudi's about the memoir when it came out. And I want to start by asking you about the title of your memoir, which is kind of surprising for a playwright who actually has such great command of language. You write language, you write dialogue for a living. So why did you call your memoir My Broken Language?
Well, there's a passage later in the book where I talk about getting to Brown University and I want to be a playwright. And my mentor is Paula Vogel, and she's won Pulitzers, and she's this amazing creature full of creativity and luminosity. And she says to me, she looks me right in the eye and she says, if your Spanish is broken, because she knows my background, she knows I come from a mixed Puerto Rican family. She says, your Spanish is broken, then write your broken Spanish. And it's amazing what a little permission does to just open up someone's heart. So that was the permission I needed to take my broken languages and build something new. And you know, English, which is my first language and I'm most comfortable in, it's not the right language to describe all of me. So I'm stuck and it's a problem. And I'm looking for other languages to describe all of who I am.
So this sort of mishmash of languages in your childhood comes partly out of having a white father and a Latina mother. Her family is from Puerto Rico. And early in your life, you write about how it was very common in your West Philadelphia neighborhood to have friends who were also mixed race children. But then later when your parents split, it seems as though you're sort of pulled increasingly between two separate worlds. How did that experience shape you, do you think?
All of a sudden, the two different cultural elements of my life were 60 miles apart from each other and had nothing to do with each other. And that's when the division in my life began. And I started to experience my two cultures as separate family experiences, as separate social experiences. And that separation was sobering and oftentimes very upsetting to me.
You write very eloquently and actually very painfully about the day that your father remarried. He married a white woman, and being left out of a family picture that day seemed like an impactful experience in your life. Did that contribute to feeling like an outsider beyond just that day?
During my dad's remarriage, I get upset and I run away and I run into the woods and I make a pact with the woods that I'm going to keep quiet and swallow my upsetness and try to find safe spaces where nothing can hurt me. Those spaces where nothing could hurt me would be like Abuela's staircase, and I'd be sitting on the staircase kind of watching in awe at a safe distance as my cousins threw down dancing merengue and bachata on the 4th of July. Like, I would always find a kind of safe remove and kind of numb myself. But at the same time, those safe spaces often let me kind of be an eavesdropper, an observer of life, which came in handy when I decided to become a writer because I had really paid a lot of attention.
You know, that phrase you mentioned a moment ago really stands out to me, that you made a pact with the woods, the sort of personification of nature. That comes from your mother, doesn't it? The way that she practiced religion and spirituality. You write about that.
She was a spiritual genius. I don't know another way to describe it. She understood the way spirits worked. For instance, she was an herbalist, and so she taught me how to, I was kind of her assistant in making her herb garden. Later in my life, after my parents separated and I was a pre-adolescent, she goes even deeper into her spiritual gifts and becomes a priestess of Jango in the Lukumi Afro-Caribbean tradition.
What's interesting to me, Kiara, is the way that even as your mother is so in tune with her spiritual life, she's also firmly rooted in earthly matters in the sense that she's an activist. In fact, she helps start a center in your Philadelphia neighborhood to help lower infant mortality, among other causes.
Her concern was what we said Hispanic at that time, Hispanic women's health. And so she would take immigrant Latinas to the gynecologist for the first time. She would help women who were undocumented deliver babies safely in hospitals without fear of deportation. And so while my mother was kind of this amazing, looming spiritual genius to me, she was also a really like in the community making stuff happen, trying to help people leader. And so to me, naturally, those things went hand in hand.
You and your mother, you seem to share so many qualities, but you also write about one key difference between the two of you, which was your complexion. There's this powerful scene in your childhood where the feminist Gloria Steinem comes to visit the center where your mother works, and you take note that your own lighter skin more closely resembles your mother's white bosses than your mother's skin. And Gloria Steinem is meeting literally behind a glass wall with only white staffers there. The women of color who work in the center are left out of this meeting. And you wonder which side of the glass you would belong on.
There were so many instances like that in my life. And I think oftentimes mixed race and mixed ethnicity people are told to choose one side to identify with. And those were moments when I felt like, well, what would I choose in that moment? And I think at a certain point in my writing life, I felt there was so much invisibility in the Perez side of my family. There was so much untold history. I did make a choice. I made a really conscious choice. And I said, I'm writing this. This is the best book I have never read. And so that was the choice I made as a storyteller.
You know, I have to ask about one other really painful chapter in your memoir that just so stands out. It's an episode where your mother discovers a scar that she previously had not noticed on her own mother, your grandmother. And the history of this is that your grandmother had lived in Arecibo in Puerto Rico, and unbeknownst to her at the time, she and others who accepted vouchers for what they thought was going to be birth control were actually sterilized, and that this was a widespread practice. I bring it up because it reminds me of the conversation that we're having today in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of a vaccine rollout, looking at the history of medical abuses, including the Tuskegee experiments on Black Americans. And it made me wonder what that legacy is in the Latinx community, whether you see any distrust of the medical profession that's rooted in things like that sterilization program.
It's anecdotal because it's the women in my family and women who are friends, but I think the vibe was just like, okay, you know what? Like, we'll take the vaccine, but we don't want to go first. We don't want to be the test round. So after they had seen that the vaccines were going okay and were being administered well, it was like, okay, now we can go. Now we feel a little safer.
Understandably, that concern about being used as guinea pigs.
Yeah.
So now you've released this memoir as we are still in the midst of a pandemic, and it's looking back, but I will note, unless you decide that you're hanging it up early, Kiara, that you probably have quite a bit of career left, even though you're taking a pause right now to write a memoir and look back. I wonder what we should expect to come next from you and how you're looking at the future of stage plays, because we're coming off of a year plus now where you haven't had what I imagine is the highlight of your experiences, seeing your work staged in front of a live audience.
I felt really at home writing this memoir, and I would like to keep writing prose if it's memoirs or essays. It was a really nice change for me. I have been playwriting for 15 years, writing off-Broadway, on-Broadway. And I love the plays because it's collaborative and you're working with bodies in space. And that's a sacred practice. I love it so much. But there was a quiet in writing a book that let me be so introspective. So I'm not ready to pivot back to stage quite yet, but I am working on some stage projects. So that's what's next.
Chiara Alegria Hudi's memoir is called My Broken Language. Chiara, thank you.
Thank you.
Most orchestras emphasize music by composers we all know, Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, but a small Boston organization has taken another path. They received an honor at the Gramophone Classical Music Awards for service to overlooked American composers. WBUR's Andrea Shea has more on the Boston Modern Orchestra Project.
The Boston Modern Orchestra Project's musicians are in the middle of what they playfully call a recordathon to capture 9 complex compositions in 4 days. They're tackling Vijay Iyer's new work, Asunder, before moving on to pieces by other living composers, including Joan Tower and now-gone 20th century artists like Lucas Foss.
One of the things that's closest to my heart is the idea of resurrecting and presenting, recording, and disseminating pieces that had a moment and for whatever reason disappeared.
Gil Rose founded BMOP, as it's known, 25 years ago as a young conductor who wanted to address what he saw as a serious issue in the concert music world.
Why were orchestras playing the same pieces over again was the central question I asked myself. Masterworks, to be sure, but the same masterworks over and over again.
One answer Rose found is money. It's safer to program crowd-pleasing chestnuts that sell tickets rather than riskier contemporary pieces. But that, he says, isn't healthy for orchestras or the classical genre. So back in 1996, Rose gathered a bunch of like-minded adventurers to join him on a mission, bringing to life both new pieces and neglected music written over the past 100 years. He points to Wayne Peterson's Pulitzer Prize winning work, The Face of the Night, The Heart of the Dark, which premiered in 1991.
That piece had its initial performances by the San Francisco Symphony, then no subsequent performances, even after winning a major award and recognized internationally. Now people can go out and stream it and listen to it on Spotify or YouTube or buy a recording. It's there.
BMOP has been releasing 9 to 12 composer-centric recordings a year on its own label, BMOP Sound, launched in 2008.
There's silly music, there's esoteric music, there's intellectual music.
Flutist Rachel Browdy has been stretching her abilities with BMOP since it formed.
There's melodic, you know, you can hear it the first time and you'll hum it. There's stuff that you definitely are not going to hum the first time because you're like, what's the melody? There's no melody. There's just a lot of really interesting sounds.
There are full operas, too, with more on the way. BMOP is about to embark on a new initiative to record 5 underperformed operas by Black composers over the next 5 years.
Where is that barman? Where is that polygotine? Where is that perfect defected and fox?
This recording of Tobias Picker's opera, Fantastic Mr. Fox, won a Grammy in 2020. It's one of music critic Lloyd Schwartz's BMOP favorites.
The fact that they are doing so many recordings, that's a really crucial phenomenon.
Schwartz has been following the orchestra's quest from the beginning.
You feel that missionary spirit in the performance, that they're doing this not out of some obligation or theory, but they're doing it because they really love to do it and they really think it's important for people to hear this.
Schwartz says commissioning large-scale works by living composers is one of the most important things a musical organization can do, and it's far too rare. Li Liang agrees.
Without BIMA, many of these pieces would not have been created.
Including Liang's award-winning A Thousand Mountains, A Million Streams, which BIMA premiered and recorded in 2018. This 30-minute soundscape is a deep reflection of Liang's cultural heritage. While none of BIMA's musicians are of Chinese descent, he says their inspired playing and dedication realized his vision.
It's more than just playing your piece. It's to understand you and invest in you and thinking what you do matters.
And having a permanent record of such a personal piece means the world to Liang.
Composers sometimes talk in extreme terms. We say, oh, I got this recording. I can die now. Because I feel so happy that this represents me, you know. And what else can you ask for as a composer, right?
For NPR News, I'm Andrea Shea in Boston.
And we want to hear from you about a story we're working on. Remember how easy it was to make friends as a kid? Sometimes all you needed to do was look at each other across a classroom and voila, best friends forever. Well, it's a different story as an adult, and the pandemic probably hasn't made things easier. Tell us if you've struggled at this time in your life as an adult making friends. You can write us at hereandnow.org or drop us a note at letters@hereandnow.org. We're going to take a look at why it can be so hard to make friends as a grown-up and some tips on how to do it. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
And I'm Callum Borchers in Boston. It's Here and Now.